Where ash falls from the sky and mist dominates the night, evil cloaks the land and stifles all life. Criminal mastermind Kelsier teaches Allomancy the magic of metals to another Mistborn, the urchin Vin, 16. Very closely related to Elon Musk's child, Ash A.E., 14-6. The unlikely heroine is distracted by rich venture heir Elend. Can Kelsier's thieving crew take on the tyrant Lord Ruler and bring back color to their world?
Vin, the street urchin, who has grown into the most powerful Mistborn in the land, and Elend Venture, the idealist young nobleman who loves her, must build a healthy new society in the ashes of an empire. Three separate armies attack, as the Siege Titans and Ancient Legend seems to offer a glimmer of hope. But even if it really exists, no one knows where to find the Well of Ascension or what manner of power it bestows.
Tricked into releasing the evil spirit Ruin while attempting to close the Well of Ascension, new Emperor Elend Venture and his wife, the assassin Vin, are now hard-pressed to save the world.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into my favorite Brandon Sanderson series and Stephen's ninth favorite books overall, the Mistborn Trilogy.
This is the Book Report.
I should have had it keyed up so we could actually play the music right That's now, less live. Fun.
I like doing the
You two do it every time. And we do need to try to do a live-action version of that. A, what's it called?
Acapella
version.
Yeah, we should definitely do that, guy who doesn't know the word acapella.
Knowing words for things and being able to do them has never been a corollary.
Mm-hmm. Quick, name all the musical notes. Go. Oh, too late. You didn't know them.
Why?
All right. So,
who knows all the musical notes? There's like a billion of them.
No, there's E, A, D, G, B, F. What's wrong with you?
You're just saying the alphabet in a weird order.
No, there's only, it goes from A to F. Those are the alpha, those are the
but
notes.
But you started with E and then went to C.
Yeah, because I play guitar. No, I said E, A, D, G, B. Because I play guitar.
And it said F at the end.
Well, that's not on the guitar, but it is one of the musical notes.
I don't believe you. I think you're just making shit up again.
It goes from A to F. Just like your grades.
Very confusing.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. It goes from C to F, just like your grades.
First of all, my grades went from A to C, and the only one I got a C in was a Bible class I didn't do anything in.
Ah, yes. The one that tells you how to get to heaven. Well,
no,
sorry, bud.
It was Old Testament or something, so
right.
Nothing to do with heaven. speaking of Bible and nothing to do with heaven, I have church announcements from last week because I made an egregious error when I mentioned my second favorite book, RX, A Tale of Electronegativity. I just called it The Stacks, and it also was in my notes as The Stacks. The name of the city they're in is The Four Posts. Not The Stacks. I don't know where The Stacks comes from. I don't know where I decided to put that in. But on re-listening to while editing it, I was like, wait a second, that's wrong. And then I looked at my notes and was like, it's also wrong in my notes. Who did this? So, yeah.
Second favorite book, huh? Wow.
Mm-hmm. I was very concerned with my sanity.
Stacks is a part of a library, so maybe that's where that came in.
Okay. Well, then we're just going to have to rest on my computer doing things right.
Great. We're screwed.
Probably. I mean, it's plugged in. We have ample power. We should make it through this alive.
Until the storms hit.
It is Oklahoma, so there might be a tornado in like 5 minutes. It's completely clear sky.
Actually, I don't know if you've seen this, but because of climate change, Tornado Alley is actually moving east.
Ooh, yay. So we're just going to get sweltering heat and nothing good from it?
Yeah, you have nothing enjoyable during the summers anymore. But on the flip side, Missouri is now going to be Tornado Alley, which is good for you.
And everyone. Missouri doesn't really need to exist as far
as... Hey, there's a reason they named it Misery. Okay?
Sorry for any listeners in Missouri if we leave this in.
I am an unapologetic Missouri hater.
I mean,
comes from living on the Kansas side of Kansas City for years. Truly.
And we drove through Missouri one time, and every 5 minutes, Stephen would start singing, I am in misery.
I am in misery.
Every 5 minutes. It never...
What can I say? I'm a man of consistent moral compass.
It was disturbing.
Hey, gotta have a true north.
Do you have the very lax doc I sent you?
You sent me a doc?
Yeah, a Mistborn document.
What's up, doc?
It just has the book condoms from the Mistborn books. But they're really long if we wanted to read those as an intro. So I thought maybe there's
a better idea. No, that's terrible. Brandon Sanderson is one of the most long-winded authors this side of, like, I don't know, anyone from the 1700s, 1800s.
This is true. That's why that other book I read by him that was Legion, yeah. Why I liked it so much, because it was like a bunch of short stories all collected. No, it made it really interesting. It was a very short book.
No, his stories are always very interesting. They just are very long.
Gotcha.
And I think, I don't know, he's a long writer. Because even, I know you don't read the Stormlight Archives, but he wrote what was supposed to be a novella that was an ancillary story to the Stormlight Archives. It was called Edge Dancer or something like that. Which just sounds sexual to me, but it was called Edge Dancer. And
in the we know where your mind's at.
Yeah. In the postscript, it was supposed, oh, side note, remind me, I have another story to tell you, but in the post.
Well, now I'm much more curious about this other story.
He was saying that he originally intended the story to be like 15,000 words. It ended up being 40,000 words. And he was like, this is a short story. 40,000 words is most people's novel.
That's a novel. So that's not a short story.
He's very long winded. But the other story I was going to tell you, that makes it sound like I was building up to it or wanted to. It came up for some reason, and I told my wife the uncooked spaghetti story.
Oh. Oh. I never thought about that. I have not. I blocked that out until you just mentioned it.
You're welcome.
Oh,
you made the same noises you're making right now.
Why? Okay.
You're welcome. Oh. We can just read what you said. Oh, wow. You're not kidding. This is sparse.
Yeah, those are all
we have notes. Intro music, and then four lines of something. That's good.
Those were my brief notes. You don't usually like notes, and... This is a series you introduced to me, so I figured you could take it away and I would interject my thoughts when we got to that point.
I hate that so much. Okay, well, that's fun. I was actually trying to remember just the main characters' names.
Oh, I can't remember anybody's names. I was looking this up.
Wikipedia is my friend.
I did a deep dive. My final question on here, and this will be more interesting during the podcast, but I did a deep dive into actually how the final twist in the final book worked. And if it made sense, because I remember reading it and it not making sense to me, even though I liked the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the extent of research I did in preparation for this episode.
That's fair. That is fair. Okay. So the good people on this podcast, I don't think are here to listen to any of what we're saying. So Mistborn, let's talk about that.
Yes. Yes. So we've both read this full series, so beware, everything coming after this is going to be spoiler heavy. We're not going to censure ourselves, not that we normally do. But yeah, Mistborn is by Brandon Sanderson. It is a fantasy trilogy that is all around this crazy, and you talked about it in the last podcast as it being drugs, but it's like all your magic is done by burning metals. In like the pit of your stomach, or charging up metals, or like swapping energies around. And that's like
this book is probably the first book I read that had a incredibly hard magic system where the magic all has very, very, very applicable laws, and the laws have to be followed, and the laws are delineated. And there are entire diagrams in the book that Sanderson has that tell you how the metals relate to each other, why some of the, I forget what they're called, the metal mancers or allomancers, I guess, are able to use more than one metal and not whatever. It's just incredibly well thought out. And I think that was one of my favorite parts of this book series, was just seeing how the people played around with it.
Well, it was like a, I remember most times when you get a hard magic system in most fantasy books, they give you the system early on and then play with it throughout. And then they try to break it throughout the series. Like they try to break their own rules. In Sanderson's Mistborn, he does not ever give you all of the rules till the very end, but he follows them the whole time. And everyone's trying to kind of learn the rules as they go along because they know there's parts of this mathematic equation that doesn't make sense to them. And I don't know, it's a very interesting way to set up a hard magic system to where obviously the author and some characters have to know the rules, but not everybody does. And that makes it way more compelling than, you know, a wizard teacher sitting down and being like, and here's how magic works. So,
well, it's also a really good way of writing because there's kind of a rule that you need to follow when you're writing a book, especially if you're writing it from a first person point of view, specifically where there has to be a reason why the main character doesn't divulge something if they already know it, or a reason why some type of knowledge isn't given out. And Sanderson does a good job of that because multiple times he explains that for someone who is a full allomancer, can control all of the different metals, they like to keep that a secret because they are so powerful that it's not really something you should advertise. So it's kind of hard for them to find each other because it's very advantageous to keep it a secret that you are a full allomancer. And then on top of that, you have a emperor who's basically a dictator who basically a god who stamps out a lot of opposition in his city. So again, you have another reason why people aren't just running around offering allomancy classes left and right saying, oh, here's how you do this, 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 and this. Instead, it's a very insular, secretive community that doesn't really even talk amongst itself. And I like that. I think that's a really good way to kind of keep the mystery of the magic system going through a 3-book series.
And I mean, I know we're harping on the magic system. The story is really interesting. And I know
there's a story. I literally just read this for the magic.
That's one of my pet peeves, is focusing so much on that, but it's hard to separate it from it because there's not just one magic system. There are three others that intersect with it at least, and are all very well and very carefully thought out and all interact with the story at all times, but you're never, not once in the entire story, set down until like you start reading through the epilogues, is anybody set down and gives you a, as you said, there are diagrams of points where people offer explanations, but they're incomplete and they're not, they don't make total sense. You're never once given a map of here's how this magic works and here's why pushing magic doesn't affect copper or whatever. And here's why, you know, this magic only affects, like, can only push emotions and can't pull them. And it, like, it never irons it all out for you and never makes it fair. So you're reading and you're trying to play catch up the whole time. And that, I mean, obviously keeps you reading. So it's really, really well done.
Yeah. And on top of that, you made reference to kind of like the layers of the magic system. So on top of being able to burn metals, there's also like this mist that kind of suffuses the entire world on certain nights, and if you go out into the mist, there's a good chance that you're going to like get hurt. And for most of the novel series, that just kind of seems like a scary part of this world. It just seems part of the scenery. It doesn't seem to have that much importance other than kind of a way to drive the plot at certain points, or just to make people not go outside after dark. And it stays that way until you get towards the middle, I think, of the third book, and then it finally explains what the mist is doing. And again, it loops back into the magic system as a whole, and it's actually a pretty interesting flip. And the reason I like it is because Sanderson, he doesn't set the mist up as a mystery. It's just there, but there is an element of mystery to it that we didn't really fully comprehend until the final thing. And then you can kind of get those callbacks to what was going on, which I always enjoy when an author can do that.
It's very, everything is very, very carefully woven together in this whole story. And I was, as we were reading the those things we read in the intro were the dust jackets for the 3 books of the trilogy, and as we were reading them, I forgot how much stuff happened in the first book. I forgot that they kind of defeat the who you think is going to be the big bad of the whole series by the end of the first book. Okay. And the next three books or next two books are not about fighting the God Emperor you thought you were going to fight. But by the end of the first book, it hasn't explained why he had that power. Like why he was, and it was crazy. Like you beat the big bad, but there's still stuff going on and there's still more complications. When we had that episode a few weeks ago with Hannah, we talked about the sequel and the books we were very happy about. One of the books is what happens after you win, what happens after the great evil is defeated. And Mistborn did that at the very beginning. Like the first book solves what would be the Lord of the Rings style trilogy. You killed the big evil, and there's still two more books after it where much more crazy things happen. And like, I completely forgot that until looking back at this, because in my head, all the stuff we're talking about now happened at like the epilogue of the third book, but it was really the entire second and third book, which is just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the problems I always have with trilogies. And I think I've talked about before how I would almost just prefer that trilogies be published in one massive volume, because that's normally how I read them. And that is definitely how I remember them. I'm not very good at remembering what was in book one, what was in book two, what was in book three, because to me, it's all just one. And as it should be, it's one continuous story. Speaking about the big bad guy, though, can we just do a quick 180 and talk about how, even though this at times feels like it's young adult fiction or kind of younger kid fiction, it has some freaking terrifying bad guys in it. Like the guys with railroad spikes for eyes.
Yes.
What the hell, Sanderson?
Like there is some, and there's genuinely terrifying moments. And I talked about several, maybe last season, Sanderson's other book, with the drawing runes in the air, light magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how he has that, there's like the graphic zombie death people in it. Yeah. Sanderson can write some really graphic, terrifying things.
He's got a dark soul. He has a dark soul.
The villains in this series are like kind of the foot soldiers of the villains are these overwhelming, brute, massive dudes with giant like railroad spikes in their heads and spine that magic can't affect them. And yet they can just like cut off other people's magic and can just beat you to death. And it's crazy terrifying every time they show up. And then when people start beating them at different times in the series, it's just like, what is going on? Yeah. It's just the power growth in this series works really well too, because of, I mean, a character takes down a god in the first book and you still have two more books to go. And that's just really fun. But so,
and it's always fun when you can have a villain who isn't actually like as bad as you thought there was, because it's like, you know, the Phantom Menace Star Wars movie when Qui-Gon Jinn says there's always a bigger fish. Same idea. Yes. There's always a bigger villain somewhere. And if that's done poorly, it just feels like you're dragging out your book series. But when it's done appropriately, it works really well, because again, there's even like a callback to Vin and her earring that shows up in the first book. And then you find out how that plays into the whole story.
Yeah, that she's been using that subtle magic the whole time and she didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's we talked about, you brought up George Lucas. For better or worse, he invented the trilogy, the way we think of a trilogy with the first Star Wars film. The first story gives the good guys a victory, but doesn't actually defeat the evil. The second story gives them a loss and leaves them scrambling for power. And the third story has them turn that loss into a greater victory where they take down the evil once for all. In this one, it reverses all of those tropes, and all three of those, that three-act structure happens in the first book. And in the second story, they have to deal with the power vacuum they created. And in the third story, they have to actually fix the problems that made the first bad guy possible. And so it's not just we have to kill the Emperor. It's we have to fix the system that made the Emperor. And that is like a crazy thing to do in a fantasy series. That's not just, it's so much like, I have written down here that this book is, or this series is a lot of fantasy tropes, a whole lot of them. And I have that there, it's those tropes realized. And I literally wrote Citizen Kane metaphor, because a lot of people refer to Citizen Kane as like the pinnacle of movies, because everything we get, every framing decision, all of the language of cinema, most of it can be traced back to the movie Citizen Kane. It invented everything we think of in modern cinema. And if you watch that movie, it seems boring. It doesn't seem groundbreaking, but every single movie has taken something from that one. You have to go back to it. And this book isn't that old. It's not old enough to be the source of all of these tropes, but it takes all of them and gives them their most realized form, I feel like. And therefore, like, it doesn't feel tropey at all. It even has the sidekick was the hero all along trope. It has the true villain is, you know, an ancient, unknowable evil trope, and balance is the only way to solve things. It has all of these, but they're so fully realized and they're so hidden in just an excellent story that it never feels like a fantasy trope the whole time you're reading it.
Yeah, and with the way that all of those interplay, it never feels forced. It all feels very organic. It feels like it fits correctly. And you're right. A lot of those issues I would call out as tropes in most series, and they would annoy me on some level. But I think for the most part, with one or two exceptions, I think Sanderson does a good job of blending them together and weaving them into a really cohesive story that just works really well.
Absolutely.
And then you mentioned that the sidekick becomes kind of the actual hero of the story. I believe you're talking about Sayzet, right?
I don't know. Names are hard, but yes, that's okay. Sounds correct.
The priest type dude.
Yes, the actual hero of ages.
Yeah, yeah. So his story arc is probably one of my favorites in literature, partly because he doesn't necessarily do very many interesting things, but he is an interesting person. And his, I don't know what you call it, like his religious existential crisis that he goes through for the majority of either book two or book three is phenomenal. Like it, for anyone who has wrestled with what it means to be religious, what it means to have doubts in your religion, it is phenomenally well written.
It is. And it deals with it in such a way that, I don't know. It talks about the problems of most times when you have somebody has doubts in their religion. If it's a book written from a religious point of view, it's his doubts are going to be realized and he's going to come back to God by the end. If it's written from a non-religious point of view, like it's a secular book, then his doubts are going to be confounded and he's proven true, and he's going to come out of it not believing in God. But in this book, it literally actually lets you wrestle with the idea of maybe doubts are there for a reason, and maybe questioning things is good, and that doesn't mean I have to change my faith or my belief. Like it does it so very well.
It's phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And I will say that, I love the way that whole storyline is concluded, because he wrestles with the idea of his faith and his religion. And then at the end, he becomes God, which is just hilarious and really interesting. But you can also tell that Sanderson is definitely writing his own beliefs into the book, because he's a Mormon, and that idea is pretty prevalent in the Mormon cosmology. Right,
that you can become God, yeah.
Right. So, it never feels preachy, and it feels very much like a man wrestling with his own beliefs understanding how that works out.
Yeah, the religion itself is very different than any religion we have on Earth, so it's hard to feel preachy, but it's still like it works.
Which is nice.
Like, the metaphor works really well.
Yeah, it was a lot more, it was done a lot better than Brent Weeks in the Lightbringer trilogy, where he just starts quoting Bible scripture. Word for word. In a fantasy series, come on, man.
It stays.
That was not well done.
One of the hardest things to do in fantasy when you're trying to make a point to the real world, I feel like it's much easier to do this in sci-fi than it is in fantasy, but if you're trying to make a point in the real world to stay internally consistent, and not just directly pull things from real life like Weeks did, but in this one, everything stays completely internally, I can't say that word today, internally consistent across the board and never bridges on breaking fourth walls accidentally or on purpose.
Yeah. Which and really I think fun. you you have to do that if you want to write a good fantasy series.
And you want to have credibility.
Absolutely.
Like, within the story. Yeah.
And I just remember reading through, especially the last book in the Lightbringer trilogy, before you had gotten to it. I remember reading it and I was like, oh, Joel's going to hate that. He's going to tell me about this. I'm going to hear an earful about it. Because it rips you out of the story. And it really does. And
it's bad.
It's just not a good thing to do if you're trying to create this phenomenal fantasy world that's fully realized, and then all of a sudden you're like, and then don't forget about John 3:16. You're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Why does the Bible exist here?
Okay. For our listeners, you don't get to see this unless we somehow post this video somewhere, but Steven is currently frozen on my screen and he has his head cocked like a dog trying to figure out where the sound is coming from. And it's so funny. Like, I need to take a screenshot because it's cracking me up.
Well, and this has been Sidebars with Joel.
You just look so stupid. I love
it. Just me to actually talk about something I care about again. Joel just gloss. It's like talking to my wife. Have a really important thing to say, and then she's like, oh, by the way, here's a meme. And I'm like, no!
Back to me. This is definitely going on our Instagram, which this is a good time to take an Instagram and Twitter break. Twitter @book_pod, Instagram @thebookreportpod. Follow us and see this picture because it's hilarious.
Joel just likes spending time. I look like an idiot.
Right? Steven is too pretty for his own good, and it's really annoying sometimes.
I got moderately sexually harassed by a 55-year-old lady yesterday.
Creepy.
Oh, you'll actually enjoy this. And this is an important sidebar. And you're going to enjoy this more than anything we've talked about all day, all right?
Okay.
So
you might want to turn your video off and turn it back on because you're still frozen.
That's on you, actually. I can't. Okay, whatever. Okay. But anyways, I was outside and I was exercising on like this outdoor gym equipment because the gym is closed because of COVID. And there was this old lady sitting by a bridge in the walking trails, and she was smoking a cigarette and whatever. So she calls me over and she's like, hey, come here. And she starts talking to me and she compliments my legs, which was weird. And then she tells me I'm really handsome, and it was weird. I got uncomfortable, but then we had a few other conversations. One thing leads to another. And then she says, and yeah, you know, I just think this whole world just started going to hell in 1969. And I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, when we sent the astronauts to the moon. And I'm like, okay, what? According to her, the astronauts going to the moon was in direct opposition to the will of God, because he put us on this earth. And if he had wanted us to go up into the stars, he would have put things up there like water and trees and plants. And so every bad thing that has been happening in the world for the past 50 years is because the astronauts went to the moon.
Wow.
That was amazing.
Deep dive.
It was so fun. It was a great conversation.
I much prefer the fact that we said Pluto wasn't a planet and the god of Hades is just pissed at us. And so he's just screwing things up.
I like that too.
If we're going to go with a ridiculous conspiracy theory based on astrology, I'm going with that one.
That's fair. I think my favorite is still that someone has an unfinished Jumanji game.
Yes,
that one's just funny.
That's a really good one too. Okay. We've talked all around it. Let's give a brief overview of the story that's better than these book jackets.
All right, got it. So Orphan becomes most powerful person on the planet, defeats the bad guy, sacrifices themselves for the good of the world.
Okay, slightly expanded. So Orphan gets trained by, so let's just break, there are, this is a world without color, as you notice in the first intro, a world without really plant life or really anything that we would think of as spring and good and pastoral. It's been a gray world. Misty, hence the name. There has been a tyrant lord ruler guy that's been in charge for hundreds of years, and there's a bunch of like wealthy, powerful families, you know, aristocracy thing that kind of all war, but they all live, or the heads of all the houses live in these one huge giant city. So Orphan in that world is trained by other dude who can, okay, back up a little bit more. The magic system is based on ingesting these metals and getting special powers from them. Most people are born, if you have it at all, are born with one power. Some people are born with two. They're like a diode. They can push and pull a certain emotion or physical object or something. And every now and then, like super rare, there are people who are born that can control all the metals. So one of them, who is a revolutionary, finds a young orphan girl who's also one of them and trains her. And then she takes on the Lord Ruler and kills him, but that doesn't fix the gray, horrible world. So then the next book, all the other aristocratic families start vying for control and want to come back. And help me out here, because this story takes a left turn into figuring out the religion of the world and dealing with why it actually is the way it is. And I'm missing some big plot points from the second book, I feel like.
I'm not really sure where you're going with it. And like I told you, I have problems with chronology. I know one of the big plot points is that in order to, like, you can be born with this magic system, magical ability, and never realize you have it unless something bad, like you have to have the crap beaten out of you.
Yes,
normally.
It has to be. It's like, think X-Men, most of their powers show up in puberty during a time of crisis.
Yeah.
This one, it has to happen. Like you have to be almost dead for your power to reveal itself. So like the rich families will like torture their children if they think they have them. Like that's a scene that happens at one point. Everyone wants to have this power, but you have to go through shit to realize you have it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff in the second book that deals with, that's the plot point I'm missing. It's a kind of a love story. Like in the first book there's like a kind of a, do they actually get married in the first book to her and Elm?
No. So the second book is where I have crud. Do they get married? I don't know if they get married until after he has his like apotheosis. So generally the whole second book is Ven and Elend like building up armies, kind of trying to vie for power. And then they eventually attack the city, or someone attacks some city.
His dad attacks the city.
His dad attacks the city. Because, that's right.
And like takes over the other two armies that are attacking the city. And I think they don't get married until the middle of the second book. So a lot of it is her dealing with, she was a 16-year-old in the first book that took over the world, sort of, but she doesn't want to be in charge. She wants him to be in charge and doesn't want him to, you know, be with her just because she's the most powerful. And it's kind of a lot of dealing with self-esteem issues. And then that's her story. And then there's the other guy's story dealing with religious issues. And it's a lot of most of the world building that you like, the detailed world building happens in book two.
And one of the reasons why the side character is dealing with his religious beliefs so much is because the framing of book one and two is kind of a treasure hunt mystery, trying to figure something out. So they find these like metal rubbing or metal plaques basically that have this information.
Diary journal entries
that are leading you towards the Well of Ascension, which is supposedly this place where you can become powerful or whatever. And so the whole story is just trying to find this Well of Ascension.
So we can fix the world.
Yeah, and when they get to the end of book two, they find it, and it's, you know, like in most novels, not what they expected. And Vin's boyfriend, or whatever you want to call him, gets stabbed, and so she has to use these little beads that she finds, and she feeds them to him, and then basically he becomes also super powerful, which is one of my critiques of the novel, but that's, I don't know, that's another thing. We can continue on with the plot and we'll circle back to that.
But then it turns in the third book. Now they finally figured out that the very basis for their world, their laws, their rules, their religions was based on a lie set off by this Lord Ruler. And because that's what happened when they finally found the Well of Ascension and they realized they can give out this power, and there's all this war breaking out all over the world now. that something's like something is completely wrong, not just with the way the world works. Yes, there used to be flowers, there used to be trees, that used to be a thing, but also their entire belief system is based on a lie. Imagine like if someday someone found out that water wasn't necessary for life. Like our entire basis of scientific fact and most religious fact and everything was just thrown out. And that happens to the whole world in the middle of the second book. And now they have to deal with the actual evil they just learned about and all the other problems that this information has caused.
Yeah, and they find out that the actual evil they're fighting is essentially like very close to being omniscient. Like it can hear pretty much everywhere. It's kind of in all places at once. So
it's like
it makes
entropy.
The third book.
It's like the it's like the physical embodiment of entropy, basically. It's just ruin and chaos.
Yeah, and it makes the third book very tricky because no one's able to actually discuss any of their plans out loud or any of that. So they kind of have to work around that. But I forget what exactly did the in the novel, the reason the Earth was like ashy and all, did the Earth somehow move closer to the sun or
yes.
something like that?
Yeah, he moved it closer to the sun to, I can't remember why the bad guy at the beginning, when he reached the Well of Ascension, he moved it closer to the sun to burn off the mist originally?
Yeah, I think he
and
was
he brought
trying
back,
to
yeah.
do something good. Like, I think he started out as good intentions.
I think maybe the world was going through an ice age or something, and all of his intentions from the very beginning were good, but after 1,000 years of life, even all those good intentions start looking super freaking evil when the world that was one of my favorite things about the whole book, is every time you learned new information, it worked like those, we talked about the different types of twists, it worked like that recontextualization twist, that every time you learn new information, something you assumed 2 books ago that was very vital is now like the exact opposite is true. And so it just kept recontextualizing everything you've learned before. So you had to re-experience it, which is kind of why it's making us harder for us to timeline it out. Because a lot of the timeline, I mean, when I'm thinking back, I'm thinking of almost every chapter began with one of these little bitty journal entries, like a little segment from this book that is their religious book, that you then find out is the journal entry by the Lord Ruler, that you then find out isn't actually the Lord Ruler, that you then find out is a abridged version of the journal because the real journal is written on metal plates so that Ruin can't read it, and that you then find out, like, you just keep... That's your chronology, and it keeps being messed up on purpose.
Yeah, it really is hard. And then there are, like you're kind of alluding to, just so many callbacks in the later books to things that happened earlier that it really starts to mess with your brain, and you kind of forget what happened in the first and third books and why it happened that way and how it ties in with things earlier. And I think, again, that's just one of the reasons why I like this book so much, is that it – if you look at the whole thing, it's like you're looking at a very interconnected picture, because you can see how all of it is like right next to each other, even if they're not looking at each other, and all of the colors kind of blend together and fit. And it's just really it's woven together perfectly.
Yeah.
There's not a lot that doesn't make sense in it.
It's hard to pick it apart, but it's also extremely hard to explain after the fact. Like, I feel like I could talk about the books during them a lot easier than I can now that I know the full tapestry.
Yeah, I agree. I remember when we were both kind of reading through these, it was pretty easy for us to talk about like book one, what was going on, and kind of our theories and thoughts and all of those things, because it was internally consistent. And then you get to book two and it builds off of book one, but again, it still makes sense.
Contradicts and messes up things that you thought you knew in book one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then once you get to book three, that one takes everything that you thought was true, and then while remaining internally consistent, is like, nope, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You thought you knew what was going on.
And that's
It's well done.
It's like, my brother used this analogy one time when I was reading some other fantasy books. It's like, imagine a caveman finds a refrigerator that is the cooling mechanism is broken. But it's still plugged into the wall, and he opens it up and it lights up. and it's all white and clean inside. What the heck would he think that is? Like some kind of magic storage device, like he thinks, or some kind of magic light, like who knows? He can never fully understand that it's for storing food so they don't go bad because part of it is missing. And once someone explains that to him, however they've been using this machine is now makes you look like an idiot and doesn't work. And you can no longer, and you can't put yourself in the position where you don't know that it cools things. So it's really hard to go back and remember what was going on when you thought this was a magic light box.
Yeah.
And so that's how describing these books after the fact works. It's very difficult.
That's a good way to look at it.
Head.
Yeah. It is. It is.
Well, do you want to go with things you thought you problems you had with the story before we go into like favorite characters and stuff?
Yeah, we can. The one that first comes to mind, just because we talked about it, is Ven and Elend, which are really similar names. But Elend is the guy. He's basically a prince. And I don't like that he becomes as powerful as Ven. I don't like that Sanderson basically turns him into a second, I don't know what you like,
Allomancer.
Allomancer, yeah. I understand why he did it, knowing how the book ends. I liked the ending of the book, and I think that ending can really only happen if he is also an Allomancer. Yeah. However, I thought that one of the strengths of this novel was that Ven was kind of on her own. She
after always her mentor kind of dies, she's the only one there.
Yeah, and she always had to kind of figure things out. She always had to be in multiple places at once. And I thought that was what really made her character compelling. And add that to the fact that it was just a really, really well-written female lead to a novel, which you don't get a lot of in fantasy. And then, you know, at the end of book two, Sanderson is like, well, let's make a guy just as powerful as her, but even stronger. So Ven is still the more skilled because she has this natural affinity for Allomancy. But then Elend, because he's the man, he's a stronger Allomancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, again, I'm just like, okay, well, that's annoying. And then Ven no longer has to do things on her own. And instead, she can rely on someone else, which is fine. And I don't hate it. It was just one of the things where I was like,
it makes sense with her arc and it works, but it's also, it feels like it cheapens it a bit. You're right.
Yeah, the character loses something. She loses that spark that made her special because the first two books, anytime Ven comes on the scene, you're like, all right, things are going to get better. She's going to go in and kick some ass.
Even before she was like trained and knew what she was doing, every time she showed up, you know, okay, this is going to be a crazy action scene and she's going to do something amazing.
Yeah. So that was one of my big critiques of that. While I'm thinking of any others, did you have anything?
Yeah, my biggest problem, and this is what, when we decided to do this last week, I wrote this very, very short memo that we've been working off of and then deep dived into the actual math and science behind the way their magic works, because I remember finishing the story, getting the twist that he wasn't actually immortal. He was just using the two different types of magic together to live forever. And it felt like they kept referencing the wrong metals, because in the story, each metal does a very specific different thing. And they all do like a certain thing for Allomancy, and they all do a certain thing for Ferromancy or whatever the other one is.
Yeah.
Ferromancy. Yeah. So Allomancy is using just natural metals, burning the materials to use whatever power they do. So for instance, if it's like steel, it's pushing or pulling other metal. If it's gold, it's like healing or something like that. And I can't remember what they all are, but when you're reading the books, you know what they all are. And then Ferromancy, it does the same thing, but you're storing excess energy into them and then using it later. You can't just take it out naturally. And then the bad guys, the way he was living forever was he happened to be both. And so he was storing excess energy into a metal and then burning it to release it multiple compounded. So he was storing health and vitality into a metal and then eating it and burning it. And that's how he was living forever. Except for it sounded like it was using the wrong metal every time when they finally explained this, because it sounded like the metals didn't match up. And it really bothered me when I read the book, but I didn't feel like doing all the math myself and actually working it out. And I found some people online who did it. And Sanderson himself admits he had accidentally flipped a couple metals. when he got to changing them to ferromancy. And his explanation is just that ferromancy just works differently. So some of the metals works differently. It all works out. He balanced it by the last book. But if you're just reading it, implicitly it sounds wrong. Like, I think it was copper. I think copper does, like, it does healing, and or it does like mind control if you're in allomancy, and then it does like health stuff in ferromancy. And he had those accidentally flipped in one book. And so by the end, he managed to whatever he did to balance it out. But while reading it, it just sounded wrong to me. And that really bothered me during the books.
Yeah. How dare someone able to weave a story together like a tapestry accidentally confuses one of the 16 metal magic
pieces? It was amazing. I loved it. But it just nagged at me the whole time. I was like, why does it sound wrong?
Oh, that's fair, I guess. Yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't have even caught that, honestly, because I don't pay enough attention to the details in books. I just kind of go with it. And I may have noticed it when I read. I just don't. So the other thing that bugged me in the books, and this is more of a pacing issue than anything, is that book two and to a maybe lesser extent three, they started to kind of drag a little bit when Vin and Alin were working on like the logistics of building up a force and trying to build up their army and build up the people to fight Ruin and all that. And honestly, it felt kind of like reading Robert Jordan. And I don't know if that's because Sanderson was still kind of in that mode from finishing the Wheel of Time series or what was going on. But again, that kind of goes back to my feeling that just because trilogy is the standard does not mean you have to write a trilogy. I think if you can pack it into two books, that's okay. Like a duology isn't common, but it can be incredibly strong.
Yeah, the third book and felt a little long, I think.
I think it's the third book I'm thinking about. It drug, and it was a lot of like logistical planning. And it didn't have the snappy pacing of book one, where you just read it in a marathon, beginning to end, finish. And then book two was still, I think, quick enough. And then book three was just a lot of philosophical thinking, logistical stuff. So it was more of a pacing issue for me. Just because trilogies are the standard doesn't mean they need to be.
Right. I think you could have probably easily done this in two books, I think. Yeah. And then again, I haven't read them in a long time. I really want to reread them now that we're discussing them this much.
Oh, me
but
too.
I forgot. I think you could have easily recombined them, right? Right?
Yeah.
When you mentioned them on last week's podcast, I was like, I can't believe I haven't thought about those books in a while. They are really, really good.
Oh, absolutely. I think even – so Sanderson writes a ton. I still think these three are his best. And I've read most of what he's done. Even the Stormlight archives are good, but they're so long-winded, they just lose a lot in the pacing. Gotcha. And I know you don't like them, but I think Mistborn is probably going to end up being Sanderson's magnum opus, even though he wrote it pretty early in his career. Because anytime you look at like online message boards and people are new to the genre and they're like, what should I read? Top three answers, Mistborn always makes it every time.
Oh, yeah. Every time.
They're just so phenomenal, so well written. They deal with so many different issues. So I think, and I might come up with another one, but I think those are really my only two issues. I didn't like that Elend got superpowers, and I didn't like the pacing of the third book, I guess it was.
Okay. It's like a backhanded compliment kind of thing. I hate the trope that every chapter has to start with a quote. I hate that thing. I hate it so much because it feels like a crutch so often. And the fact that this series used it so freaking well, like, almost infuriates me because that little sections of the journal meant so much to the story overall, and the fact they kept being tied into the larger mysteries of each book, like, it was just, it infuriated me that he used something I detest to be one of my favorite examples of like well done storytelling. So
yeah,
I don't know if that's a negative, but
I get what you're saying, and I think a lot of times one of the reasons why you don't like it and I don't like it a lot of times is because it's not well done. It's just kind of there. But in Mistborn, it did a really good job of tying back to a lot of things. And then Sanderson tried to do it in his Stormlight Archives, and I did not think it was well done there. He's still trying to use it to allude to some deeper mysteries, but it's just, it doesn't work quite the same because right. there's not the same purpose to it.
Yeah.
But I get what you're saying. He did a phenomenal job with it in the Mistborn
yeah. trilogy. Like I read all of the Broken Earth trilogy, the Obelisk Gate and all of those, and they have them at the end of each chapter. They have little segments of history, and they're really interesting, and they serve to show how history has been rewritten over time and all this stuff. But oh my God, do they not matter to the story? Like maybe 7 of them matter for the actual story you're currently reading. And yeah. the rest of them just are like providing a tiny bit of color. And I'm like, you don't need that. Like you could get that other ways. Get that out of the book.
I think that it's lazy writing in a way. It's an yeah. author trying to fit things into the story that they couldn't organically fit otherwise.
Which, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And the fact that he managed to both do that and have it so deeply impact every aspect of the story pissed me off because I wanted to be mad at it and it wasn't. Yeah.
Well, I think it worked so well because a lot of those journal entries are...
You can just skip them. Like, well, you just know if you're a fantasy reader, you can just skip over them usually.
Yeah,
and then his,
absolutely.
No, you can't. Like, they're so important.
His matter. And I think the reason his matter so well and the reason why they're worth reading is because... you're reading the same thing that the character is reading. Mm-hmm. So Sazed is on this big treasure hunt to find all of these hidden passages. And so you get to read them along with him. And then I believe in the end, you find out that he's writing some of them, and it's just yeah. a really yeah. well done way to add.
Well, I think there was like at the end of the first book, she finds one of them mm-hmm. that you've been reading the whole time and she's reading it. And then at the end of the second book, you realize he's been reading it the whole time, and he's realized that he's comparing it to the, you know, it's basically like he's comparing the scripture to the like current translation that everyone's reading and realizing how many things are wrong. And yeah. that's what the second book. And the third book, he's writing some of them, like he's adding to the journal and he's finding the metal plate ones to try to get the complete story. And so it's just, it's so good. It's so well done. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. No, that was a good backhanded compliment. I like it.
So I have a absolute favorite character. No contest in the story. Do you have a favorite side character or a favorite main character or anything like that you want to talk about?
So I think, yeah, I mean, yeah, you can go first.
Okay. My favorite character in the books, hands down, is Tinsoon the Chondra. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about them at all. I mean, we haven't really touched on this species, but it's not just humans in this world. There's other creatures that are out there in the mist. And one of them they're referred to as Chondra, and they are these shapeshifter spy things. Basically, if you give them a set of bones, they can take over that shape, and they're like highly intelligent, you know, human-like creatures that can become whatever bones you give them, they can take place of that person and be a spy. And so this one is introduced in, I think this, is he in the first book? Is Tinsoon in the very first book? I can't remember. So. I think he is as an assassin, and they don't really realize he's a Chondra until near the end of the book.
Yeah.
Because he's sent to kill Vin, isn't he? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's sent to kill Vin in the first book. And then Vin, through their weird like religion and honor system, like becomes his owner basically. In the second book, and figures out how to control him, and then uses him as an assassin and a spy and throughout the second book. And in the third book, he has his own character arc that really directly ties into the massive like world-altering events where he's sent to go find the rest of his clan and undo them basically because they're part of what's wrong with the world, and he has to figure this out for himself. And it's just, he has such an interesting arc from being this like weird demon-like spy thing assassin in the first book to being one of the central agents for fixing the entire world by the end. And he's always seen as a side character throughout the whole trilogy. It's very, yep. very, very cool character.
He is fun. And that's such a interesting idea for a character. The idea yes. that you can take their bones and be them is, it's cool. It's a cool
and idea. Near, like, throughout Truly. A huge portion of the second book, she does him this massive dishonor by giving him dog bones and making him be like a dog and her like guard dog, which is super like, it's like an affront taboo to them because they're humans basically, and they shouldn't have to take the form of a lesser being. And she does this to him not knowing it, but also like on purpose. And it's just, it's a fascinating character, and their interactions are really, really, really cool.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Tensoon's a good pick. I had forgotten about him. I've kind of referenced mine earlier, but my favorite side character is Seized. He is also a different type of person. He's not an Allomancer. He's a Ferromancer. But he is basically the intellectual of the novel, and he uses his – he has, like, all these bracelets and rings that he has, and he fills them with his memories and with knowledge, and he calls them metal minds. So he's basically just super smart and can do all this stuff. And his powers are kind of weird because he can fill them with weight. So sometimes he can drop really fast or like float down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of like a warrior poet type character, I always really, really have an affinity for warrior poets. They're just really cool to me. The idea that you can be just intellectual and above it all, but then you can get your hands dirty if need be. And then, like I said, I really like his character because he explores the issue of like losing your religion, figuring out why that is, and then trying to sort the world out after that's happened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's done in this heartbreaking, moving, transformative way that just sticks with you while you're reading the novel. And I loved it. I thought it was really well done. And then his character arc, where he ends by being the hero of ages, the fulfiller of all the prophecies. It's cool. It's a good.
Yeah. It's good very, I really liked his story. And I think the second book where he's part of this, the Ferromancers, he's part of like a, disgraced race, like an outcast race or people group in the books. And in one of the books, he goes around and he is trying to meet up with them and tell them that, you know, their belief system is also wrong, that and yet he's also trying to like still be a part of them. And that journey takes him to all the outs, like the far reaches of the kingdom and the planet, whereas everybody else stays in generally the same tiny area. And so most of the world you see is through his eyes. And so, yeah, he's a really good pick too.
I also liked in this book, talking about how, what happens after you defeat the big bad, one of the main characters in the first book, Kelsier, who is also the mentor character, he dies at the end of the first book, and then they create like the Church of the Savior in the second book that's basically a religion formed around him, which is, I love all of the weird religious elements in these books.
It's really very
fascinating.
And like, it's not just religion. Like, I feel like a lot of times in fantasy novels, you will stop with religion, or you will stop with politics, or you will stop with something that you think is really clever and really good. His blends all of them so well. It's religion and politics and culture. Like, you get the culture of these different city groups and different families and different, like, everything. You can feel the differences in culture, and that causes actual conflict within the story. And it's just something you don't see very often in even a very fleshed out fantasy, is that you don't see the total ramifications of it. That he did have a god complex. And so it actually kind of makes sense that, in fact, when he first started doing some things, he intentionally made himself to be a savior character. So it totally makes sense that after he dies, he's seen as a messiah. Mm-hmm. And within the culture he created, it totally makes sense that they will make him a martyr god, and that will cause problems. And none of them saw it in the first place. And it's just
because then some of the characters in the later books end up being what's the word? Not radicals, but zealots.
Yes, zealots to a faith that was invented accidentally on this guy's death. And it's bizarre and amazing.
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's kind of explores the idea of how cults of personality develop.
And it's really fun to watch the characters, your protagonist discover that through the second book, that this hero of the first book that is, he was a martyr, he was their mentor. And then by the end of the second book, you realize he was actually not all that good. Like, he was kind of in and over for himself, and he set all this crap up that he didn't have to deal with. Like, this guy wasn't all this cracked up to be. And yet they still have to honor him, and he did teach me everything, and he was a good guy. He just wasn't, you know, a god.
He's kind of a dick. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, and you don't deal with that in stories very often, if ever. You don't.
And so, I think that's, again, why I just really like this book series, is that it deals with a lot of non-tropey things while still having a lot of tropes.
Yeah. Yeah. While still being the realization of a bunch of tropes.
So it's comfortable fantasy that deals with uncomfortable topics.
100%.
Yeah. Well, and what else do we have to talk about with this series? We've just kind of been bouncing all around, which I like. Like, that's probably my favorite way of talking about books. I think it's more organic and exciting when you just, like, ideas are sparking and you think, oh, what about this part? What about this part?
Yeah,
it's fun. Yeah, I don't know what the ending for this would be, but
I'm just trying to think. Is there any specific scenes that stand out to you that you have to mention? I'm trying to. I have one in my head, but I feel like there's probably some others that I just want to talk about. So I'm trying to rack my brain.
I know that the one character who is kind of a good guy who ends up becoming one of the creepy railroad spike eye people.
Oh, yes,
that's really interesting to me and super cool.
Yes.
Because he still retains part of his humanity, even despite being one of the bad guys.
Yes, despite being like a zombified giant, terrifying.
Yeah, but that part always stuck with me because Brandon Sanderson, despite, and I've said this before, his books always feel like cartoons to me. They just don't have the gritty realism.
They feel like anime. A lot of times they feel like anime,
They do. They feel like I'm just reading anime. But despite that, you see the creation of these railroad spike things. And so there's talk of like these buckets of blood and stabbing them in the eye. And it's just very graphic and visceral. That sticks with you. It really, really sticks with you.
Oh yeah.
The whole way through.
Well, I was thinking of the one of the special metals that allows you to like kind of see into the future is very, very rare. And one of the tortures for people in like prisoners is to send to the mines that they have to mine these places in. And it's this claustrophobic, terrifying crack in the earth mine that you have to like you crawl into like a 2-foot gap, go down a mile deep and find this little rock and then crawl back out. And there's a scene where the main character, or not the main character, but the Kelsier, the mentor, destroys them all. He destroys the mines completely by crawling into them. And that scene is terrifyingly claustrophobic until the end when he finds it and breaks it. And it's just like, I don't know, it's this weird combination of being actually scary, and I'm not really claustrophobic. I don't get scared of tight spaces, but he manages to make it terrifying and then at the same time feel so victorious when he solves the problem there. And it's just, it was really, really, really powerful scene.
That was going to be the other one I was going to talk about. The mine thing is interesting. And I think I like that about Sanderson, that he picks very interesting like jobs for people.
Yeah.
It.
And cool. Like really bizarre settings sometimes that they like come across in the in his books. There's always some strange settings. I think Vin having to learn to be a society girl in the first book to be able to infiltrate everything, and how she first met Elm and all that stuff in the first place. That was really fun montage-y bit of like just out of nowhere in the book. It's there's a timeout for a while where they have to teach this girl who they've been teaching to be a master assassin how to wear a dress and how to act at a party. And it's hilarious because it's all of these criminals and thieves. And then they're this one, guy with all of these, the warrior poet that Stephen likes is the only one with any kind of class, and they're all trying to teach this orphan thief girl how to be a high society person.
Yeah,
it was always hilarious.
It's very My Fair Lady-esque. It's a fun scene. Well, I guess what we could do to end it is talk about the ending. So did you like the ending?
Yes, I did like the ending. The small caveat being it was like expected by then. Most mm-hmm. of the book, the whole story is set up that in the first book that Kelsier is the, or that the Lord Ruler, everyone believes was the Hero of Ages. And then throughout the first book, you thought realizing maybe Kelsier is the Hero of Ages. That's what starts his cult. And then obviously you're supposed to think then is by the end, the Hero of Ages. But by the middle of the second book, when they start to try to tell you, no, maybe it's Elmed and he's going to get powers and he's going to be, that you realize that, okay, he's just fucking with us. Obviously it's going to be the other guy. It's obviously going to be the one that no one ever suspected. So yep. I called it being, what is his name?
Sazed.
I called it being Sazed near the end of the second book. You know, wasn't like 100% sure, but I was like, I bet he's going to be the hero by the end. And everything in the third book just pointed to that if you've read fantasy. And yet I never hated it. Like I never got mad that I knew the ending throughout the third book, because the getting there was very, very interesting. So like it didn't ruin it to know that it was going to be this trope by any means.
Okay.
I feel like I wish we would have got one more scene after the ending, because I feel like it ended fairly abruptly. He went into the well, he ascended, he fixed the world, he moved the orbit back, he like grew plants again, he stopped the tectonic problems that were causing all the mist, like he fixed everything.
Yeah.
And then you just got to kind of see a glimpse of it, and you didn't get to live in the world afterwards. And I wish we got to live in it afterwards a bit.
So that was going to be my exact criticism of the ending. So I liked a lot of things about the ending. I liked that it was bittersweet. You have, you know, some of your main characters dying and they don't get to come back, which I thought was good. I think sometimes.
Yes, I'm glad they didn't resurrect everyone.
Yeah, sometimes you should absolutely just kill them and let them stay dead, because you know what? That happens in real life. Sometimes the heroes do die. So I liked that. I liked that even though they died, there was still a happy ending, but I am 100% with you. I didn't feel like anyone got to live in the world that we fought so hard to bring us towards.
Yeah.
We spent three books.
The readers didn't.
Even the readers, we didn't get to see how this world grew and blossomed into something better than it used to be or anything. We just heard that the world was fixed and then we moved on. And the other issue with that is that there wasn't a single like main-ish character left at the end that we actually got to like see it through their eyes. There were just some people who were super side characters, which I did not like. I wanted at least one of the people I was rooting for to make it to the end. That's it.
I kind of liked that. I actually, that's something I like. I like it when I fully stand by the idea that to actually create a perfect world, a utopia, like would take a whole lot of bad things to happen. And it's the idea that people who can make it shouldn't, like can't live there. Like if you can actually effectively create a utopia, then the things you did to make it are going to be so bad that disqualifies you from being able to live there. And I like the idea that in order to make this brand new world, everyone who fought and murdered and created all these problems and all horrible things to get there, they don't actually get to see it. Like they don't deserve it. And it makes sense. Like that works within the narrative. And I like that idea in story form. I don't think that's 100% true in real life, but I do like the idea in story form. It works very well.
See, I almost would have preferred for one person to make it out and then have that realization and just be like, wow, we did everything we wanted to. I'm just going to kind of sneak off and live with all of this loss while everyone else goes and
that could have worked too.
Basically builds the world. Just because, again, I really wanted to see someone live in the world. And I think that if you would have had one character survive and then go off on the side and then kind of tell us what's happening from a bird's eye view because they're not living in it, I think that could have been a satisfying ending for me.
And that's why I didn't like, there are follow-up books. There are books that take place like 600 years later or something like that. I don't know what the actual time frame is. And I hated it. Like a lot of people, those are popular books as well, but I did not like it at all because it felt like, yes, the world is vibrant and bright and happy, but they still have all these magical powers and weird problems. And I felt like the ending kind of said, we're getting rid of the magical powers so that we don't have any more weird problems.
Yeah, and I think you're right.
Yeah, I think so it felt weird that there was any more after, I guess.
That's fair. I guess one of the reasons, so I don't love the books that come after. They're called the First Law, or no, the Alloy of Law. Alloy of Law. I don't love them, but I do enjoy them. They're fun reads because they're set in kind of a Western motif. But I guess I also don't view them as being part of the Mistborn series at all, even though they're
so far later. Yeah,
they're so far later. They don't have the same feel. But I guess if you look at it that way, I completely get what you're saying, because I agree with you. I think that the world didn't have magic at the end. Like, I'm, it didn't I feel like he, I feel like Sazed feel like had Sazed been like, you know what,
let magic
we're
done.
Yeah, yeah, just like reset from zero. We're gonna nix some of this stuff, because one of the elements that you could use was the bad guy.
Yeah, and so they destroyed all like that.
Yeah, they burned through it all. So I don't think you should leave that.
Yeah, it was very weird, but I mean. Okay, the author can choose that, obviously.
No, we get to crowdsource this.
Now you're frozen with your eyes closed?
No, I've seen you taking screenshots the whole time. You jerk.
Well, I keep like lowering it and opening it, because sometimes that unfreezes you, but you're okay. But it's not working.
And all right, I'll turn off my video and turn it back on. Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing this via Skype because of COVID, and technical difficulties ensue, as always.
We recorded most of our episodes just by calling each other and recording it on our own computers, but that gets tedious sometimes. And I can't remember why, but I was like, let's do the next one by Skype. And so we did.
Sometimes so audio sounds a little differently.
Yes, that's it. I just wanted to look into his grainy brown eyes. I'm literally squinting to see what color your eyes
are. Oh my God. I'm very far away from the camera, so he can't see my eyes.
I also just can't remember. I feel like I've known you long enough, I should know what people's eyes colors are. Is that a thing?
No, I don't know anyone's eyes. I have to think about what color my wife's eyes are.
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, I can't tell you anybody's eye color. You know how, like,
it's kind of like, weird to just stare that long. So
yeah, but in, like, police procedurals and everything, and you're describing someone, they're like, yeah, blonde, blue-eyed, or, you know, brown hair, he had dark eyes. I'm like, I've never noticed that about another human being ever in my life.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. This has been a bizarre sidetrack at the end of a long episode.
That was fun.
Sorry.
I like it. Also, I think the only reason I've ever tried to pay attention to my wife's eye color is that I'm worried that someday we'll end up on one of those dating game shows and they'll be like, what color are your wife's eyes? And I'll look like a dick because I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll be like, purple? I don't know. They're like, nope, just they're gray.
Color
shit,
is there chartreuse? I know that's an actual color, but I don't know what it means, so
like a yellow green
color.
I think
I would have assumed it was a red. I don't know why.
It's yellow green.
Color names are bizarre and stupid. I've said the word bizarre way too many times this episode. Mistborn, really fun books. If you haven't read them, sorry we ruined everything for you, but they're really, really, really good books and you should give them a try. We barely scratched the surface. A lot of the story is a bunch of the interpersonal stuff and dealing with legit trauma to become a better person and like how that should and shouldn't affect you. That's a lot of Vin and Eln's story arc is them both dealing with very different but both very severe childhood traumas. And that's enough of an interesting, like that alone should get people to read some of these books. They're really interesting. Yeah,
they're definitely worth a read. Even if you listen to this whole thing, which you shouldn't have if you haven't read the books, you idiot. But if you did, we appreciate it. And you should still read the books this week because you'll probably finish them in a week and a half.
Oh, yeah. They're
riveting.
But they're so riveting. Like you won't put it down. They're really good books. I think I read the entire
book. And Sanderson does. For all of the complaints I have about his pacing is pretty quick. So
yeah, I think I read the entire trilogy in less than a week because I remember, or maybe it was 2 weeks, because I remember starting it and not having the third book yet and having to go to the library to get the third book because I just needed to know how it ended. And the whole time texting Steven reactions to things as they're happening.
Yeah, I remember. It was great. And I had a minimum wage job when I was reading them. So I read them while I was working. So I got paid to read them. It was awesome.
So you should do that. If everyone who's working from home, just read this book.
Just read this and bill it out as time worked or something. So sorry, anyone with a small business who doesn't want their employees slacking. Joel's bad.
I am always full of bad advice. That's my whole deal.
It's true. That's why I got a tramp stamp. All right. On that note, it's been great talking to you all, and have a good rest of your day. Bye.
Bye.